the pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to this very special edition of the Empire Podcast. Did you know the Star Trek turns 50 this year? Well, it does. It doesn't look its age, doesn't look a day over 47. And to mark this momentous occasion, we at Empire decided to produce a special supplement dedicated to all things Trek. Movies, TV, the whole kit and caboodle. That's on sale now. Here's the big sell. That's on sale now, packaged with the new issue of Empire, which has Star Trek Beyond on the cover, helpfully enough. But we didn't want to stop there because we love Trek. So this podcast is boldly going where no Empire podcast has gone before. Over the next hour or so, I'm getting together with two or three, depending on whether one joins us, of Empire's resident Trekkers to discuss the franchise and its incredible legacy. And those Trekkers and their area of expertise, because I want you guys to say what excites you most about Trek whenever I introduce you, okay? R. James Dyer.
Kaploch.
Oh, for God's sake.
Klingons would be what excite me.
Okay, I thought you said Kerplunk.
No, not Kerplunk. Kerplunk, it's Klingon.
For what?
Hello.
It sounds very hostile.
Well, that's Klingons for you.
Isn't it a child's game?
Kerplunk is, yes.
Klingon is not a child's
game. I don't believe Kerplunk. It does involve sharp sticks being stuck through things.
You see?
It sounds quite Klingon.
No, it involves sharp sticks being removed from things.
Oh, so that's not very Klingon at all.
No, it's not. So that's James Dyer, who loves Klingons. You heard her as well. Helen O'Hara, how are you?
Very well, thank you. I guess I just like the space exploration.
Yeah, just
space.
I like the space, man. That's
no,
what
and
I
the
like
problem
about
solving. We were talking about this in the office the other day, but I'm very fond of stories where intelligent people be intelligent. Do intelligence
like on the
well.
Empire podcast.
That's
yes,
right.
Like that sentence, what I just spoke.
I like when intelligent people be intelligent.
Yes.
Right.
No, but you know, films about smart people doing smart things. So things like
Dude, Where's My Car?
Spotlight.
Oh, yeah.
And things like The Martian and things like the whole of Star Trek.
Yes. Star Trek. Okay, good. Space and smart people.
Space and smart
space
people.
Smarties.
Yeah.
Kerplunk. Excellent. Johnny Pyle is going to be here at some point soon. I'll ask him when he gets in. And then he may only be here for like 20 minutes, so we'll beam him out. We'll beam him in and beam him out again. And then there's me, of course. I'm not a hardcore Trekker. I love a lot of the films, but I say I'm probably a next-gen guy.
Mm-hmm.
I like the original series. I like next-gen. I'm very dodgy on Deep Space Nine, really dodgy on Voyager, and I don't think I've seen a single episode of Enterprise.
Can I say I reject the term Trekker? I think we should embrace Trekkie. Trekkie was deemed
Trekkie
to be pejorative, so it was changed to Trekker to be slightly more PC. I am a Trekkie and proud. I am not a Trekker.
I prefer Trekkie because it sounds more fun.
Yeah.
But Helen, where do you stand on this?
I don't have a strong feeling on it. Mm. I think if the traditional breakdown of the two phrases in the 90s, by those sort of definitions, I would be a Trekker rather than a Trekkie because I can't name chapter and verse and episode title in relation to everything. That said, I'm not going to argue. If somebody calls me a Trekkie, I'm like, sure, fine, I'll take it. I've been to two conventions, you know, I can't argue.
And we're valedictorian for your university Babsock, let's not forget. And,
that is not a thing.
While Babylon 5 may be a big pile of shit, you were.
Get out.
I like Babylon 5. And
I like Babylon 5.
And I like DS9, which I've just started watching again. Now it's on Netflix, hooray. And great, great dramatic
the
shows.
The fact that Trek is on Netflix is a great thing.
Every single episode
of every single show,
including the animated series,
including Enterprise,
including Enterprise. Yes.
Should I watch Enterprise?
You should watch Enterprise once you watch the other stuff. Enterprise isn't a bad series. It is a series with a Rod Stewart song at the beginning, which is unfortunate. It's not actually
that
Rod Stewart, but he. Interestingly, that song was written by someone whose name I forget, but first performed by Rod Stewart on the soundtrack to Patch Adams. That's a
wow!
Fact for you.
So it starts bad, and
they started using on Patch Adams, and then it got worse, and then they rewrote it for Enterprise, and then realizing that it was a dreadful song, they reworked it to make it more upbeat and a bit more rock and a little less country, and frankly it wasn't much of an improvement.
Yeah, that's fascinating to me, because I think one of the great things about Trek that I love is the music. It's got roughly three, and you may think the Deep Space Nine theme tune is iconic as well, but for me, when I think of Trek, I think of three iconic themes, and that's pretty amazing. I can't think of anything else. I mean, Star Wars obviously has lots of different refrains and motifs and themes, but main themes, you know, maybe Superman maybe has three, Batman maybe has three great themes, the Danny Elfman theme, the 1966 theme, and the Hans Zimmer, James Newton Howard theme. Maybe you could argue that. But Star Trek has the Alexander Courage theme. It has the Next Gen theme, which I believe is Jerry Goldsmith. Yep. It has James Horner's great score for Star Trek 2.
Glorious.
Incredible.
And Michael Giacchino's amazing, unbelievable theme for the reboot.
Which been humming in the
week,
office.
All week.
I'm so, so
non-stop.
Sorry. I saw a film I cannot tell you that I've seen, but the score is so good and he's so good, and that it's amazing, because what he did is he went in a completely different direction, but at the same time there's little nods and little throughout his scores to what went before. He's so good
and I love also that. A pun machine.
Yes,
has
machine.
Anyone seen the listings?
Yes.
For Star Trek Beyond soundtrack, it's glorious. Yeah.
Or any of his soundtracks, in fact, yeah.
Enterprising Young Men and all sorts of stuff. It's quite astonishing. We will have a structure to this, so it's not just going to be randomly talking about Star Trek for the next hour, although it will be. But what we wanted to do was split this basically into four segments: TV shows, movies, characters and moments, and our favourites and maybe least favourites therein. Intelligent people being intelligent. So, Jimbo, Heleno, let's start with TV shows. Because this isn't as cut and dried as I think it would be. Pardon me. For me, it's Next Gen, and then because I haven't seen the others. Next Gen, which I love. Jimbo, you're not an original series fan, are you?
It has moments of genius. You could argue that some of the best Star Trek episodes, I think, are from the original series. So, you know, City on the Edge of Forever, Devil in the Dark, stuff like that. I began in the 80s really with the Next Gen. Don't get me wrong, I'd watched original series as a kid, but it didn't resonate with me. But I recall in my teenage years, I'd seen them off and on, but I remember I went to my local video store, which was pre-Blockbusters. It was called Ritz Video. And they had the two-part pilot for Star Trek The Next Generation as a video you could rent, Encounter at Farpoint. And I rented it, not knowing what it was, and was kind of like, this is magnificent. Which is wrong, because it's a dreadful pilot. But really, really loved it. And I think that was my first exposure. And then later on, Sky did this thing where they obviously bought the rights to it. And on Sky One, there was an episode of Next Gen every single day, which started just as I got in from school. So I literally watched it every single day. And Next Gen really resonated with me in a big way. I mean, famously, it doesn't really get going until sort of 3 years in. But it doesn't. It really doesn't.
No, there are great individual episodes before that, but there is nothing.
But there's always a hallmark. Do you know what I mean? So with Deep Space Nine, it's like Worf indicates a step up, and Riker's beard is the Next Gen.
Between seasons one and two, isn't that right? He grows a beard between seasons one and two, and that's when shit gets real.
And then they got rid of Polanski and brought back Crusher
because they'd fired her. Hadn't they?
It didn't, yeah.
Yeah, they'd essentially got rid of her and then realised that Pulaski was dreadful, and they brought her back. Gates McFadden. But yes, I love Next Gen, though Deep Space Nine is, without any debate, the best Star Trek. And it's long been a personality test of mine where I say Deep Space Nine or Voyager, which is obviously a trick question, because Voyager, while I have affection for it, is objectively not very good. And you'd be surprised how many people will pick Voyager.
I really would be surprised, because DS9 is clearly the right answer. I'm a geek from a long line of geeks, and so I had grown up with episodes of the original series, but it wasn't, I hadn't watched them in it with any kind of regularity or consistency. And for a very long time, I knew that Klingons were a thing, right? I knew that was a Star Trek baddie, and it was scary and wrong and everything. And I'd also seen an original series episode where there were sort of pancake things that like fell down from the ceiling and like grabbed onto your face. I thought those were Klingons because they clung on.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. And so it was only when I started watching The Next Generation properly, which I think it was quite late in this country. It was like 1990 before it was on terrestrial TV, which we didn't have Sky like Fancy James over there. And it was a bit of a revelation to find out that they were the dudes with the foreheads. So
wait. We are beaming Johnny Pyle into the podcast.
Hello, everyone. Just run up the stairs. I come into podcasts quite a lot out of breath. This is the second time.
You've been on an away mission.
Oh, yes.
With your beard, you are, in many ways, the Commander Riker of the Empire.
I love you for that. I love you for that.
But he just wants you to say that he is the Picard.
What, my gaffer? No way.
No, he's only doing it. I think we can all agree Chris is the Neelix.
Nice guys.
Especially funny because Chris will not know Neelix.
No, I don't know what that is. What is that?
He's from Voyager. He's the chef.
He's the chef?
Yes. He's a Talaxian.
All right.
He has a hot girlfriend, though.
Putting poison in your food.
Yes, super hot girlfriend.
We're talking about the TV shows, Johnny. So what's your Trek specialty? What do you love about Trek?
What I love, or what is my speciality?
Both.
Wow. Well, Next Generation is me. Mm-hmm. That's when I got into it, and we used to watch it on Sky. I assume at the same time as James that I was in Fence in Lancashire, and you were, I don't know where you're from. And we were watching at the same time, little knowing that 20 years later, we'd be in a dingy pod booth.
Yeah, it's not good.
Talking
we haven't holodecked
Trek.
This place up. If this is a holodeck, we really need to think bigger.
Yeah.
And bolder than the grey, horrible, stain-splattered walls of the Empire Pod booth. Yeah, Next Gen, Deep Space Nine.
I love Next Generation, but it's Deep Space Nine.
No original series. I was so into the Next Gen when it came out, when it first started airing on BBC Two, that it kind of got me retroactively as well into Star Trek, the original series, and I started reading some of the novels, and I even started writing some. I just remember this. I wrote a fan fiction story.
I would love to read that.
A slash fiction story.
It wasn't slash fiction. There was no, you know, it wasn't. Oh, maybe it was.
Oh God!
No, there wasn't. There wasn't any of that stuff going on. I can't even remember what the plot was about. But it was on the Enterprise. It was a Kirk, Spock, and McCoy story. I remember that much. I used to like get the Star Trek magazine and rip out all the posters and the Next Gen posters, put them on my wall, and then that weirdly that phase kind of ended around. I loved Next Gen up until The Best of Both Worlds, and then when that second parter didn't resolve quite in the explosive.
Hang on, so you loved it up until the bit it started getting good?
Yeah.
No, I looked it up. I kind of stopped watching it after that.
That's literally where it gets good.
Well, I stopped watching it after that.
Wow.
Wow.
Although I will grant you the second part of that is nowhere near as good as the first.
Yeah.
I've watched intermittent episodes. It was very hard to watch episodic TV on BBC Two back in that, whenever that was.
The thing about The Next Generation is it elevated Star Trek into something it hadn't been previously. So, like the original series, it's adventure, it's derring do, it's swashbuckling, you know, it's boys' own stuff. Whereas I think The Next Generation had this, and this is all Roddenberry, because he had these very clear strictures as what it should and shouldn't be, but it emphasised the best in humanity. You know, it had the, you know, there's no war, there's no money, it's all about the common good. The ship was this amazing place where they had families you can imagine living, and it became, for me, just the ultimate escapism. You know, you just watch this, like, you know, some people might go down to the pub after a hard week, you know, have a few drinks, and I would sit down and just mainline The Next Generation, because for me, this was kind of this weird space-based utopia where there were Romulans trying to kill you.
I mean, yeah, but Romulans, eh? Eh? Isn't it? I agree. It's we talked about this a little bit in the supplement with the magazine, but Roddenberry's theories on the future and how mankind would evolve are so kind of idealistic and
not off the mark.
Well, we can hope that that's wrong. Let's not be depressed by the current state of affairs. After all, if you think about it, in Star Trek timeline, there should have been World War III already. So actually, we're ahead of the curve in terms of working towards this kind of utopia.
It's coming.
It's coming.
We can hope. But yeah, what's interesting is that, you know, behind the scenes, it was an absolute nightmare to put together, especially in those first couple of years before they kind of found their footing. And also what I learned researching this was that they had to kind of find a way to make it work, find a way to make episodic TV work and still have time for these kind of overarching themes and that Roddenberry wanted in there. And what they finally cracked onto was the fact that they needed to focus on a different member of the ensemble week to week. And that by doing that, they find a way to make the stories work and to make these grand concepts work as a piece of drama as well. And almost every major good ensemble-based TV series since has essentially done the same thing. Maybe except The Wire, you know. But that's what everybody does now. You hang each story hook on a character, and that's what makes it
Well,
work.
Most notably in Lost.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
And Orange is New Black does the same thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
What's interesting, I think, about Trek, certainly the original series and the Next Gen, I believe Deep Space Nine and Voyager started to move more in sort of arc-based storylines.
That's not Voyager.
Whereas the original series and the Next Gen are very episodic.
Mm. No, except the Next Gen is one big arc, isn't it? Because it starts with Q and the trial, and it ends with Q and the trial.
Yeah, but it's more bookended than art, because that's
he keeps on popping up.
He does keep popping up. That's only because John Delancey
had a 7-year plan.
That was it.
Of course they did. Yeah.
It was the new Babylon 5.
That's the thing, because they were winging it, whereas nowadays showrunners tend to have 3, 4, 5, 6-year plans, and they tend to know where things are going right from the off.
Deep Space Nine didn't start as an art-based show. It became one.
Yeah,
the Dominion War. I mean, it was genius. Deep Space Nine pushed boundaries for episodic television. It was. I mean, you wouldn't have had Battlestar Galactica without it, obviously, because you wouldn't have Rondi Moore. But it let TV go darker, it let TV go bolder. I mean, I always go on about how great I think Farscape is. Farscape wouldn't exist, you know, without that kind of template.
And also what Deep Space Nine had is, I think, because we were talking about this recently for a feature that will be in the next issue of the magazine, which I'm not going to discuss yet, but it had one of the great villains. It had actually several of the great villains. The one that I find most hissable, the one I wanted to actually strangle, was Kai Winn.
Yes.
Louise Fletcher as Kai Winn. Honestly, the most awful, infuriating, get under your skin bad guy, I think, of the entire Star Wars canon. You can keep Khan. Khan's just nasty. He just, you know, wants to kill people. She wanted to just smile at them and take over. Oh, she was awful.
But this is why she's so good, because she's a villain, but she's a Bajoran. You know, she's technically one of the good guys in many ways. Whereas Gul Dukat, who is, again, genius, he's really campus Christmas kind of villain. You know, boo, hiss, he wants to kill everyone. He's genocidal. He's also really funny.
Yeah.
You know, but you're right. She's insidious.
She's awful.
And also, Frank Langella, obviously, bear in mind, was one of...
Save it for the characters, but...
Oh, sorry. We're moving into characters.
We've
gone off-piste.
Are we in a bit? What bit are we in?
We're in TV shows.
Oh, wait, right.
TV shows, but not specialising in characters.
Okay.
But anyway, but you're right. Deep Space Nine, what was interesting was that they got around Roddenberry's strictures in that.
Yeah.
So Roddenberry said, in the Federation, we've evolved beyond sort of interpersonal conflict. We're going to just kind of get along. Mm. Everybody's too smart to let that derail them. And what DS9 did was, by introducing non-Federation characters and having them live alongside these slightly evolved humans, it gave them all those problems right back at them. So we're talking civil war, we're talking religion, we're talking, you know, just politics,
genocide, Holocaust,
you know, post-trauma,
and
everything.
They brought back vice, which I thought was really important. They brought Quark, he had gambling, he had prostitution, brought back money, which obviously isn't a thing in the Federation, in the form of gold press latinum. Interestingly, latinum is a liquid that is inside the little gold bars, and
really?
It can't be replicated, which is why it's valuable. There you go.
Oh, that is,
fact for you.
That is interesting.
You're not interested, are you?
No, is it real?
Can you get latinum?
No.
No.
It's not a thing.
No.
So they basically just took platinum and took the P off the start. The same as, they also, I believe, had an element called lutonium.
Clever. They hate peas.
Yeah,
they do not like
There's
peas.
No war, but they hate pea.
They do. But bear in mind that Deep Space Nine was the first Star Trek also to go the CGI route. You had Odo, character again. You know, you had the wormhole, that sort of like blossoming flower effect every time a runabout went through it. I mean, it was an interesting concept, because instead of being the wagon train to the stars format, where you're a ship and you're going to a new planet every episode, you were basically just stuck there and the drama had to come to you. And I thought that was great. It was a nice format, but I think it got a little stale, and that's why it was so important when you bring in Worf, you brought in the Defiant, oh my God, the Defiant, and you brought in the Dominion, and it became, you know, a sort of broader sort of intergalactic space conflict thing.
Yeah.
And it got really, really dark as well.
Yeah,
really dark.
And I think that's why they then launched Voyager, to get back to that traditional Star Trek boldly going
thing. And started a show whose principal antagonist was shit Klingons with tissue paper in their hair. The Kazon have to be the worst race in the history of Star Trek. It's just appalling.
Certainly the worst to appear more than once.
I know, but they dominated seasons. It's like, for God's sake, get rid of these things. And then, but then they moved on to the Hirogen, who were better because they were Predator ripoffs.
Welcome to the Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast.
No, we're on Voyager.
Dyer. This Voyager. Is Voyager now. We're on Voyager.
He's lost me so much. Okay, so let's move off TV shows.
Sorry. We have to touch Enterprise.
We haven't touched.
And
champion it for a little bit.
Champion Enterprise.
Yeah.
Enterprise. It's not as bad as everyone says.
It's not as bad as everyone says. And it has Sam Beckett as the captain.
He's not very good.
He's not very good.
Without giving anything away, it does have elements that feed into something that's coming up. So it's not the sort of black sheep of the Star Trek family, is it?
No, it's just problematic. My main issue with it is that Star Trek lives and dies by the diversity of its characters and the interplay between them, and everyone in Enterprise is insufferably bland. I mean, every single character is tedious. They are entirely interchangeable. Yeah, it wasn't good. And, you know, Rod Stewart aside, it just was never going to be good. And I think they really found their feet when they started going to the Zindi War stuff towards the end, and that was lots of fun. But then they ruined it with that ending, which made it a footnote in actually a quite decent episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. The one in which Riker's wrangling over whether or not to reveal some secret that his former commander had told him. And this entire show that was Enterprise was essentially a holodeck parable to help him work through his feelings.
But it did still happen, right? Those events
yes,
still
yes,
happened.
Yes, they're historical events, but the show is presented as a holodeck simulation with him and Troy sort of wandering around.
So I don't see why that matters.
They wrote that as a love letter to Star Trek fans to try and say, yeah, this is just ending your love. And it was absolutely reviled because it just trivialised the whole thing. It was like, you're telling us that this was just a simulation. It was just, you know, it was shit. It was ill-conceived.
Controversial.
Yeah. So let's move on to movies. But then, can we definitively name the best Trek TV show?
It's not Deep Space Nine. It's not even a conversation.
Enterprise it is.
All right, let's talk about the 13 movies in 13 minutes. Where do we stand on the films? What's your favourite movie, very quickly, your favourite Star Trek movie?
To be honest, I'm going to be really obvious, it's The Wrath of Khan, because the ending is fantastic.
Is it all Wrath of Khan, or is someone going to...
No, I'm Khan.
You're Khan?
I'm Khan.
You're Khan?
I'm Khan.
I thought Benedict Cumberbatch was Khan.
No, he's John Harrison.
Yeah. Khan is probably the best, it is not my favourite.
What's your favourite?
It's split between First Contact and The Undiscovered Country.
Interesting. So you're very much an even-numbered kind of guy.
Oh, well, obviously.
Yeah, the curse is alive and well.
Until the modern era.
Undiscovered Country is glorious. Absolutely love that film. You know, you haven't heard it until you've heard it in the original Klingon.
And, of course, the quote comes from Shakespeare as well.
Indeed. Well, obviously, that's... And Melville is First Contact and Khan, because they're both Moby Dick parallels.
Moby Dick,
so,
yeah.
You know.
Dickens is referenced, obviously, in Khan. There's tons of, I believe... I looked this up recently. There's tons of Shakespeare quotes in Undiscovered Country. It's not just that one. There's loads of them. They're studded all the way through.
Oh, yeah.
Christopher Plummer stands there camply shouting it over the intercom at one point where he's blowing up the Enterprise. Mm.
And in fact, Shakespeare is quoted in Beyond as well. So, a grand tradition of Shakespeare and
Star
Trek.
Well, Kirk is quite a bookworm.
Yeah, he is
a bookworm.
Mm. Old Kirk.
Old Kirk.
Yeah.
Old Kirk. Not so much New
not
Kirk.
So much
We're
this
not
one.
Entirely yeah. sure New Kirk can read.
I'm pretty sure he can.
I apologise to Chris Pine.
He reads books good. Intelligent man, be intelligent. So we all can, but do we agree with the maxim? Even numbered good, odd numbered bad? Or
until the modern era, where we seem to be going the other direction.
We do seem to be, because the last few movies have been... So there was Insurrection. That was odd numbered. That was 9, and that was rubbish.
Yeah.
Nemesis
was James.
Even numbered. No, that was rubbish. Hang on, wait your turn. Even numbered, and that was rubbish.
I actually quite like Nemesis.
Star Trek the reboot
was
very
good.
Very good.
Yeah, excellent. I really like it.
Into Darkness,
terrible.
We'll get into that in a second.
That might be a slight overstatement, but only slightly.
And Beyond, I can't say,
because we're embargoed.
We're embargoed. But
we are. Has everyone here seen it?
No.
Helen hasn't.
Ooh, lucky for you, there's an embargo and we can't talk about
I'm going to blink. I'm going to blink twice for if it's good and once for if it's bad. So listeners, see if you can guess this. What did I say?
Twice for good.
Did you get that?
That was 3.
That was 1.
That was 2.
Shit, it was 2. Oh, God, give it away. I've broken embargo by the medium of blinking. This is the first time this has ever happened. Can I be sued now?
Almost certainly.
Yes.
It was 2. It was 2.
It was 3. There
was
were
two.
3 blinks.
No, listen, look.
Okay. There were 2.
But that was different.
More of a
time.
Squint.
You did 2 that time and 3 the first time.
I didn't do 3
time.
The first
you
time.
You did.
Do 3 the first
time. This podcast has become worryingly derailed.
Oh, okay. Yes, as a man who tried to, filibuster Deep Space Nine just 5 minutes ago. And another thing.
I'm going to speak in support of Insurrection.
Of course you are.
There is nothing wrong with Insurrection. It's loads of fun. It's got some of the best gags in the entire series. It's a little bit ill-formed, and F. Murray Abraham looks ridiculous.
Okay, you just corrected your "there is nothing wrong with." Okay.
There are many things wrong with it. However, I love it. It's one of those things where it's a flawed but lovable film.
But isn't it just not very cinematic? It's more like a TV.
It's like a big double X.
Exactly.
Which, if you love Next Generation,
is
a fine thing. Because I quite like Insurrection. Mm. I've got no problems with it. In fact, I will happily sit down and watch any of the Next Gen films.
Just Worf going through puberty. I mean, come on. What's not to love about that?
Yeah, okay, that was all right. But Wolf. I don't know. It's not great. I did prefer Nemesis. I thought that was getting a little bit more into an interesting dilemma for Captain Picard.
See, I think Nemesis is the first even where it goes off the rails, because I really enjoyed it when I first saw it, and then I watched it again, I think, week before last, and I was watching it and I was sitting there thinking, yep, this is shit. This is not good at all.
Maybe
what is going on? What
enough.
Are you doing? It was not a pleasant experience for me.
Yeah, I think it's the worst of the four.
I think it might be.
Yeah,
I have a soft spot for Generations, even though, again, it's flawed. But yeah, Nemesis has its issues.
I don't like
Tom Hardy is not good in it.
You're not good in it.
James isn't in it. He is a bald man. I can understand the confusion.
I am the clone of Jean-Luc Picard.
Or Jean-Luc Picard the clone of you.
Yeah, or quite.
No.
I wish it'd been more next-gen movies, I'll be honest.
So do I.
Only four. Mm. And two of them, well, James thinks one of them, but two of them towards the end weren't great. Generations wasn't brilliant. It was good. It had its moments. I wasn't overly happy with the way Kirk went out. I'm not sure if anyone's happy with the way Kirk went out, to be honest, in that one. First Contact's great.
Yes.
And that's a shame. They had four next-gen movies and only one of them was absolutely, unequivocally good.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. And to go out on Nemesis is such a low point, I think.
Yeah.
And the whole Death of Data thing, which is just such a shameless ripoff of the death of Spock.
But at least they had the balls to keep him dead.
Yeah, but they replaced him with stupid Data.
Yeah.
Like, they'd replaced him before they'd even killed him. They were so cowardly about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that irritates me beyond words.
Plus, the only reason that has remained in canon is because there hasn't been another next-gen movie.
Quite.
If they'd wanted him, you know, he could have been in a coma, just like Dr. Thingy-me-jiggers in Independence Day Resurgence.
Yes.
What's his name? Dr. Face.
Data,
Dr. Longhair. Yeah. That's him.
What is his name?
I can't remember.
Doesn't matter. Dr. Data.
Dr.
It's
Rumack?
Fine.
Do you think they'll, when they've...
That's Leslie Nielsen in Airplane.
When they've done all these new films, the J.J. Abrams universe, I mean, presumably that then Picard becomes a captain anyway. And all that. So
reboot Picard.
We are down the other leg of the trousers of time. Who
I'm
can
getting
say?
Tingles.
But yes, in theory they could.
Are we near the genitals or near the ankle? Where are we?
We're coming on to the knee, I think.
We're tickling the balls of
we're
time.
We're really not.
So
are
presumably
we?
Then you can have interesting changes where perhaps Picard isn't the captain. He's in perhaps. Engineering.
So you're saying in this timeline, Picard doesn't start a fight with a Norsk and get stabbed through the heart and become captain and actually spends his life languishing on the lower decks?
Well potentially.
Who's to say he even exists?
What if there is no Picard maneuver?
Oh my God. How would the universe survive?
Earl Grey tea sales would plummet.
They're not for sale, they're replicated.
I know,
oh
I know.
God.
I know that. I know that one. He said, writing it down, just to make double check.
But yeah, they could. And well, I guess there might be some clues as to what way the universe is going when we see the new Star Trek TV show.
But without Picard, there'd be no Sisko either. Because Sisko becomes the Sisko that we know and love because his wife is killed by Picard as Locutus of Borg in the Best of Both Worlds.
Fight at 359.
Yeah.
So what we're saying is that Abrams' reboot of Star Trek could have the butterfly effect. So Ashton Kutcher could be Picard. Or there might be no Picard, no Sisko, no nothing. No Empire podcasts. This is
I think
huge.
The Empire podcast predates the events of Star Trek.
Yeah, but this, so we're safe.
Okay, we're good.
Captain Wesley Crusher. That's what I'm going to say.
Oh, God. That would be great if he didn't exist. If the single most punchable character in the history of Star Trek just didn't exist. Just, you know, a face I will never tire.
You say that,
drawing
but
glasses on.
One of Wesley's episodes, where it's a proper Wesley episode, is the one with Ashley Judd, the one about the video game,
which is
worryingly like Pokemon Go.
It's happening right now.
I swear to God, I was playing Pokemon. I was walking down the street capturing, you know, Squirtles and stuff on Shaftesbury Avenue yesterday. I was thinking, I have become Wesley Crusher in the episode of The Next Generation, where they're all sucked in by the little game, where they're trying to throw things at Pokemons. It's just, honestly, we're living it.
And we're living it, and we're living the teleportation era as well, or transportation era, because Johnny has to leave. He's got to beam out again.
You had an important away mission.
I have
on Riser.
Don't wear a red shirt.
All these away missions. It's sort of brownie.
Do you have a message, Johnny? A message to the listeners.
Thanks for listening.
Brilliant.
What kind of message should I have?
Just, you know, like, live long and prosper. Keep doing what you're doing. Don't give up on your dreams.
Great. Yeah, what Chris said. You enjoy the rest of the podcast, guys. I look forward to listening to it.
Make
Johnny's
it
way
so.
To. Squirrel himself down the trousers of time and pop out the fly.
That's not, they don't have, I mean, they could be.
It's Pulp.
tracksuit bottoms.
Intelligent men being intelligent.
Official gag,
Johnny,
on the podcast.
Just tried to push a pull door. This is amazing. All right, there we go. And then he left the door open. This is fantastic. This is going really, really well. All right, so yeah, the movies. I mean, let's go through them very, very quickly.
Yeah.
All right, motion picture.
Complete disaster. Barely watchable.
It makes no sense.
What's with the bald lady? I mean, it was basically taken from
the bald lady.
It's basically taken from bits and pieces of an idea for a sort of a spin-off series that they were going to produce in the late 70s, which was going to be called, I think, Starfleet Academy, and they had a sort of a central couple in that, and they basically ported them into the movie, and they make no sense, and they shouldn't be there, and nothing makes sense, and everything is terrible.
Was there also a TV show that they had in development for a long time, which would have had Spock?
They were going to do Star Trek Phase 2. Oh, it was going to have, all of them was going to have Shatner in it as well. They were basically just picking up the show again, and then they decided to turn it into a film. It has that glorious Starship Porn establishing shot of the Enterprise, which goes on for minutes of just circling the ship.
It's amazing. From the director of West Side Story, which has sip and pizzazz, and then you have this. It's so weird. I mean, I think we talked about this in the podcast before. It's so weird, the motion picture, its tone and its feel, because it was one of the movies that was greenlit. You know, people may dispute this, but you can't argue against the importance of Star Wars in bringing Star Trek back.
No. True.
Because
yep.
Star Trek, let's be honest, the series in the 60s had been cancelled. It was done. It was, you know, Star Trek culturally was pretty much dead.
Well, no, Star Trek culturally, I think, was growing.
Mm. Was growing, but not to the extent. Nowadays, it would be like you'd have petitions, you'd have fans, like
but
you
they
lobbying.
Did.
I mean, it was the birth of that kind of rabid fandom. Like, Trek conventions were almost the first conventions, and it was, you know, there was an awful lot of momentum building. There were petitions when the show was cancelled, there was an outcry over it. And rightly so, since by today's standards, it wouldn't have been cancelled.
And actually, it was brought back after the second season, even by fans.
That's right.
Passion. So the third season was terrible, but you know, it was fan passion really from an early stage. I think the fact that it was on repeats all through the 70s was what made
it was syndication that kind of did it, wasn't it?
But Star Wars
is huge, because everyone suddenly goes, hey, what have you got that's in space? I mean, well, we got this Star Trek thing. Oh, star,
you say?
Star, yep, ships, yes. Do they fire? Yeah,
take
they fire.
Take my money.
Great. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's got books, pointy ears. Great, I'm on board. And then we're going to get the director to West Side Story. It'll be awesome. And then he makes this Kubrickian epic where shots go on for days and the film's not... I don't think it's ever finished. And it's in real time. And
yet... It made decent money. Today, I believe I'm right in saying, the most profitable of the, let's say, the first bunch of them before the modern era, and did very well indeed. Mm. So then,
paved the way, did well enough. Then they kind of corrected the course with Wrath of Khan, which was so good. I mean, you know, we could probably do a Wrath of Khan podcast on this
song. That's my score rendition for you.
Button it, bay.
This is set the Alpha 5.
So good.
everything about it. I think that maybe it's just because I love it so much, but maybe it's the piece of Trek Next Gen aside that I connect it with more than anything else. But there are so many iconic moments in that film alone. I think it's the most quotable Trek. I think it's the most gif-able Trek. I love Abrams' reboot. One of probably the greatest Trek motion picture experience I've had was a few years ago when I went to the Royal Albert Hall and I saw Star Trek, Abrams' Trek, performed with a live orchestra. Michael Giacchino was there, and Abrams came on and did an introduction, and Simon Pegg came on and did an introduction, and it was just absolutely amazing. Again, going back to that idea about the score, but Wrath of Khan, oh my God, what a movie.
Well,
that
the
is.
Thing about Wrath of Khan, I think, which it gets really, really right, is how hefty the emotions are. Because I think what, you know, it sort of reflects the passion, I think, of the fans in a way, and the fact that they'd kept this thing going for years. And it made it feel like that time had passed for the characters as well, and that time had been spent together by them, and they'd been, you know, continuing to boldly go all through that time. So it sort of reflected people's lifetime with Star Trek on the screen. And because it had, those characters had that weight of friendship and loyalty and connection behind them, when someone dies, it hits you really hard in a way that, you know, this is genuinely my problem with Into Darkness. they hadn't earned that yet. They had not earned it. And so it doesn't, it just seems weightless. It seems like a gimmick. It never seemed like a gimmick in Wrath of Khan. Even watching it now, knowing that Spock will come back, it still doesn't feel like a gimmick. There has never been a time I've watched that film and not cried at the end.
And of course it has an extra resonance now that Leonard Nimoy has actually passed on.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, Into Darkness, which is a fun film for a while, and then just does Wrath of Khan karaoke, a bad Wrath of Khan karaoke. And you know, its big idea is flipping it, so it's Kirk dying, not Spock. Which just it's unearned, and it's lightweight, and I'm bringing it back immediately is a terrible, terrible idea.
But the other thing that we don't talk about enough, I think, with Wrath of Khan is just how good it's sort of. Kind of naval battles are, you know, that it's up there with Master and Commander, really, in that sense.
This is something that I talked to Justin Dillon about a little bit. It's that Star Trek traditionally isn't dynamic when it comes to space battles. It is famously two capital ships completely stationary trading fire. But I love, you know, the Reliant versus the Enterprise strafing runs, and because they've got little gun emplacements on there, sort of like when he manages to get the shield frequency. You're right, it's really tense. It does feel like a Master and Commander type thing.
And literally to the point of going into a fog bank, you know, to escape the other ship.
Amazing.
Great stuff.
The odds will be even.
Unusually, it goes straight into a good... I'm so confused by even and odd numbers. Intelligent men being intelligent. This is the stupidest podcast. My IQ lowered the second I opened that door. It goes straight into Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock, Leonard Nimoy's directorial debut.
That's right.
And the first good odd-numbered movie for me. I really like Search for Spock.
Yeah, no, it's listen, I've watched it again recently, and it is good only in the context of the films that surround it. If you watch it as 2, 3, 4, then it is actually really good. If you watch it on its own, it feels a little bit of an echo of Wrath of Khan, except, you know, with more Klingons. And more Klingons never a bad thing.
You're right, it's not Star Trek 3, it's Star Trek 2.5 and 4A. it's prologue and epilogue.
Some great stuff. I mean, it gives DeForest Kelly a lot to do when he's possessed by the spirit of Spock. And I like the relationship between Kirk and his son David. We have a sort of doomed, tragic relationship that's going on there. I like Christopher Lloyd as the bad guy, whose name you will tell me, James, because I'm sure.
I can't actually remember his name.
I'm sorry. You've been found wanting.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen that film.
You've been found wanting.
But they do the very bold thing there, so that's they blow up the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And at that point, before it had been done 15,000 times, well, twice more, it was pretty shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they replace it with the Bounty, which has a cloaking device and is thus much better.
Oh, my goodness. I feel like that they're still, you know, tiptoeing around the letter of the law there because, really, the Federation is not supposed to have cloaking devices. They're, you know, they could be in some trouble.
Oh, well, until the Defiant when it's on loan from the Romulan Star
Empire.
Exactly,
yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah,
can I say something controversial?
Sure.
We're going to race through the rest of the movies. 3 goes into 4, obviously.
Yep. Voyage Home.
I'm going to say 4 is way overrated.
This is what a lot of people say nowadays, because I think for a long time it was second only to Wrath of Khan in terms of people's affections, and now I think that as with the Next Generation, I think it's a reputation has fallen rather than grown, and it's not entirely fair either way. I really enjoy it. It's a lot of fun. It's not the most Star Trek of movies, what with them barely going anywhere.
Yeah.
But the fish out of water stuff is great.
It's a comedy, but it's not.
But it went broad, and I think Star Trek, unlike Star Wars, has always had an incredibly nerdy reputation, and its fans are in no way cool in the way that Star Wars fans seem to escape that kind of.
Do you think?
Do you know what I mean? It's interesting, and I think The Voyage Home was the first one that actually broke out. You know, normal humans could watch this film without being ashamed.
Get a life.
You know, it was a different beast. It was an interesting one. It was better for you, better for us, better for them.
That was a Bill Shatner impression. I believe. No, it's interesting because Star Trek, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, but Star Trek for me seems over the years to have had an awful lot of people in control and an awful lot of people tugging at it from different directions and pulling it in different directions. And egos were in play an awful lot. So Nimoy got to direct 3 and then 4, and then Bill Shatner went, hang on, I'm Kirk, I should be directing something, so can I direct like the worst one of them all? Yeah, sure, Bill, absolutely.
He had to. There was a clause in his contract whereby he and Nimoy had to be treated equally. So if Nimoy got to direct, he had to be able to.
But that's what I mean. But it wasn't just them. It was like Harv Bennett. And then when you get to the other shows, it's Brannon Braga and Rick Berman and people like that. And you just get this feeling that oh, I just get this feeling anyway that, you know, it needed more of a Kevin Feige type person who wouldn't necessarily. And I think that that's a product of his time. Nowadays, yeah. You would have someone in charge and going, okay, so everything has to fit in tonally. So, you know, 3 is a very dark drama in which planets blow up and people die, and then 4 is a comedy that once was meant to have Eddie Murphy in it, yeah. and it's about
it's
whales.
A caper.
It's a caper, yeah. It's sort of, you know, the Carry On Trek in many
it really
ways.
Is.
Yeah. 5's rubbish, but it has the moment where Scotty bangs his head on the low hanging ceiling,
oh, yes.
After
I
going,
know, I know
the ship like the back of my hand.
Although the quintessential Scotty is Voyage Home, where he goes, he picks up the mouse, holds it to his mouth, and goes, "Computer," and then he cracks his knuckles on a keyboard. How quaint! Genius.
And the thing I love about 5, and it's actually pictured in our supplement, is is when Kirk's climbing El Capitan in Yosemite.
Yes.
At the very beginning.
Yeah.
I really, really love that scene because Spock just kind of floats up and has a
boots.
Little chat to him in his jet boots. And then the whole rest of the film is terrible. but Yosemite looks magnificent.
I'm
so, yeah,
tell you
that's
this,
something.
Apropos of absolutely nothing, I incurred a late fine from Blockbuster with Star Trek V because I forgot to take it back.
Because you were so traumatised.
I was so traumatised having seen it. I couldn't face taking it back.
My jet boots weren't working. So 5, let's give 5 the short shrift it deserves. 6, we talked about, you really love Undiscovered Country. Nicholas Meyer comes back.
Glorious. And, yeah, absolutely glorious.
Very, very good. Cameo by Iman, of all people, as well.
More than a cameo,
but a supporting role. Christopher Plummer as the bad guy.
General Kang.
Michael Dorn playing Worf's granddad.
That's right. And it has the penal asteroid of Rurapente.
It's
so good. But weirdly,
oh, those early morphine effects.
Yeah, but that's the only thing about it that doesn't sit quite right. That you've got a shape changer in it, and it's just like, this doesn't really fit with the whole DS9 founder changeling.
Yeah, no, not at all.
That bothers me slightly. But other than that, yes, it's great. And you're right, yeah, the blood floating, the early CG effects, they have blood floating in the air after
they.
Because they have that wonderful sequence where they beam aboard the Klingon ship wearing grav boots after disabling the gravity plating. So the Klingons are floating through the air and they're just walking around gunning them all down.
Yeah. That's
well
the assassination
done.
Scene, isn't it?
Mm. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
When Chancellor Gorkon gets it.
David Warner, isn't that right? Mm. Yeah. He's such a good actor. I love David Warner. I haven't seen Undiscovered Country in years. I need to revisit it. Rediscovered Country, if you will.
That's right.
Generations, Kirk's death.
I won't say pre-internet. It was before the internet was a thing. I was at university and I went to see a film, probably The Birdcage or something. And before it, there was a trailer for Generations and I had no idea they were making this film.
Right.
And it came on and I swear to God, I nearly tore my clothes off and ran naked around the cinema. I freaked out in a level I've not freaked out before or since, that they were making a next-gen film.
Please reassure us that you did not in fact.
It was a pretty awesome moment for me.
Yeah, I think I was very, very excited in advance and a little bit underwhelmed in the event. Yeah.
It has Kirk's death, which I just have problems with conceptually and in terms of execution as well. It almost happens. It doesn't happen off screen, but it feels like it does in a weird way. And you have the meeting of Kirk and Picard. It just needed a much better script, and I would argue a much better director as well.
Pick the villains from the next generation. Why would you pick Klingon chicks Lursa and Bator? It's just like, really? That's the best you could get anyway.
Yeah, why wasn't it? Yeah, couldn't it have been? I know they went Borg in the next one, but couldn't it have been Q? Couldn't it have been? I don't know. Anyway, but
Q would have made more sense actually.
We'll get on to stuff later on. But it also has the destruction of the Enterprise. That's
it
a good sequence.
It does, and that's very well done. That's quite an emotional scene, especially when you see Riker and Picard at the end, standing on the ruined bridge before they get beamed up. It's quite an emotional moment.
Mm. So not all bad.
No.
First Contact.
There's an inconsistency I just want to point out with Generations that bugs the hell out of me. Because Malcolm McDowell says, "Time is the fire in which we burn." And that's his metaphor. And at the end, Picard goes to Riker, "Soren said, time was the predator that stalks us all our lives." No, he didn't. That's a completely different metaphor.
Well, you may have misheard.
Universal Translator went
perhaps.
Wrong.
Yeah, it's like an X-Men Days of Future Past when James McAvoy says to Wolverine, he says, "You know, I remember you. I'm going to say to you what you said to me." And then he says something completely different.
Yeah.
So people's memories just they go over time, Jason. So you know, it's fine. It's one of those things. So then we go on to First Contact, which is a lot of fun.
Glorious.
Yeah, like
we like that one. So sorry, we
Borg
can't
Queen,
really...
amazing.
Alice Krieg.
Mm. Yeah, yes. Very, very good. And of course, directed by Jonathan Frakes.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Amazing. Amazing.
Did a very good job. Star Trek had cracked space battles by that point. and they introduced the Defiant into that film, which was essentially the gunship that they brought into Deep Space Nine. So it had that fantastic fight against the Borg cube at the beginning.
I do kind of wish, if I could bring one thing from another sci-fi franchise into Star Trek, it would be the ships' names in Ian M. Banks' culture novels, because their gunships have names like Shoot First and Ask Questions Later. and I would quite like to see some of that. Anyway, carry on. That's an aside.
I'd bring Judge Dredd in and give him a seam of bones.
It'll never work.
Urban Warfare.
Oh, very good.
God. Thank you.
Then we move on to Insurrection, which we talked about, and Nemesis, which has so many flaws.
Yeah.
I think, again, it's one of those weird things where, I don't know, you had so many... Brian Singer wanted to direct a Trek movie for so long, and they gave Star Trek Nemesis to someone like Stuart Baird, who was a great, great editor, but not a brilliant director. And you get a feeling there's someone like Martin Campbell in Green Lantern who's just doing it because, you know, it's a job and it, you know, doesn't really have a connection with the material. And sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't. And I just felt that Stuart Baird in that one just did a bit of a by the numbers jobby.
I interviewed Stuart Baird for that film while he was sitting in the captain's chair on the bridge of the Enterprise at the Star Trek exhibition in Hyde Park. It was quite cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was pretty cool. Trek. Abrams Trek. I think it has third act issues, but it's a bold,
it's a really
confident,
it's a really clever, smart way of redoing Star Trek. It's not just, oh, here is a prequel. It is something different, and I think that's insanely clever of them.
It's a mainstream movie, complete crossover, even more so than The Voyage Home.
Yeah.
And also it fixes the narrative problem they've got, which is they're essentially retreading old ground in the most Star Trek way imaginable by altering the timeline, and I thought that was a stroke of genius. And I think the fact that JJ wasn't and isn't a big Star Trek fan went massively in that film's favour, much less so in Into Darkness.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. Yeah. Into Darkness is another one we could probably dedicate. In fact, we have dedicated a podcast to it.
Yes, we have.
A couple of years ago, where we're all kind of going, that's fine, a good thing to talk about. And then there's Beyond, which we can't talk about. Thanks to my
incredible... We're all blinking furiously
blink
at this point.
Ratio. So there we go. So very, very quickly, we don't have a lot of time left. I'm going to just ask you then for your favourite Star Trek characters.
Oh,
your
favourite...
Let's just go okay. One each.
No. Okay, there's obviously...
If you say Wesley Crusher, I'm ejecting you from this room.
Wait for it. Spock and Data are the core, I think, most loved characters in a lot of ways because they're the... I think growing up as a kid, if you're watching Star Trek, they're the ones that you actually come into it for because they're the ones who don't really understand what's going on and kind of, in some ways, have to have humanity explained to them while being extremely smart and capable and wonderful people.
And looking cool.
And looking cool, well. Yeah. So I think they're really, really important and they are... people's, generally speaking, they're people's way into Star Trek. I'm not saying that they're the best characters in terms of narrative arc or complexity or whatever else, but I think they are genius pieces of character work.
And Data's a narrative device, quite frankly.
Yeah. But I mean, he's in such a similar role to Spock in the original in many, many ways. But you can't really separate that original trio. You can't have one of those legs without the other two. I really don't think that they work on their own. You have to have Spock, Bones and McCoy.
Yeah.
And I think that was genius. Uhura is an enormously important figure in history, never mind Star Trek history, and I feel like she deserves that kind of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And hell, I liked Wesley Crusher, so screw you guys. I was 12. Not
Helen
even.
Helen Francis Wesley.
Get your wheat on. Well,
she had a crusher on him.
I massively fancied Beverly Crusher.
Did you?
Yeah, I really wanted her and Picard to get it on, full on.
It was all about Dax for me.
Jadzia Dax is spectacular.
Oh yes.
Kira Nerys though.
Yes,
she's
also Kira. Although when she started shacking up with Odo, there was a massive ick factor there. It's like really when she's shagging the shapeshifter, I don't even want to know what's going on in their quarters.
I mean,
really don't.
He sleeps in a bucket.
Exactly.
What are you
do you
doing?
Know what I mean? It's like come back to my house and share my pail. Please. No.
That's what you do.
I mean, I'm all for
that's your technique.
Yeah, I'm all for interspecies relationships, but that's
But she had to do that because Kai Wynn saw to it that her boyfriend, you know,
that's right.
The picture,
Vedic Barile.
It all comes back to evil, evil Kai Wynn.
Yeah.
Anyway, Picard is amazing. Love Picard.
Picard is the best.
He is
objectively,
the best, isn't he?
Yeah,
he?
You
he
know,
is
when
kind of the
when
best.
You get to it, though, he's definitely not my favourite.
Seven of Nine was cool.
Oh yeah, Seven of Nine. Although I mean, Seven of Nine, the most cynical character in Star Trek. Yes, we need to broaden our appeal. Let's get Jeri Ryan and her enormous pneumatic breasts and put her in a skin-tight catsuit. It's just like, really? This is the best you could do?
And it was a weird outfit because they
really
clearly
was.
Sculpted the outfit to maximise, you know, this whole area.
It was hilarious.
Resistance is futile, Helen.
It really was. And her first episodes were her going, like when she goes to Harry Kim, I wish to explore my sexuality. And she basically just launches herself at him.
If only she'd had Data there, because he's fully functional.
It was, yeah, exactly. It was pure sort of fanboy wish fulfillment, the whole thing. That said, she was a very interesting character.
Yes.
Her and Kate Mulgrew had a very tricksy relationship.
Well, Janeway was,
in real life, or?
In real life, very much so.
Janeway was a fantastic character herself, I think, and didn't always, I think, get enough to do with it. I think of all the captains, she was perhaps the least well explored. But she made so much of so little in so many of those episodes.
The correct answer here, of course, is Picard. But I'm going to ask you something.
I haven't given you my choices.
I'm going to get to you in a second.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you something. You have given choices. You've literally been saying nothing else but Star Trek characters.
Okay. What is my favourite character? Go on.
Your favourite character is Wibble Bibble.
Yes, that's correct.
There we go. From episode 4 of season 2 of Enterprise, when Captain Archer can't get the Coke out of the Fendi machine, and Wibble Bibble comes in, and it's a trouble with Wibble Bibble.
Truly, your knowledge is astonishing, Chris.
I could Google this stuff, but it just comes to me naturally. It's like the IMDb in my head. It's so weird. I'm going to ask you a question. Would Picard, would Next Gen have been so popular had they forced him to wear that dreadful wig?
No.
No.
Anyone who hasn't seen it, Google it immediately. It's horrendous.
Did they shoot it, or was it just
a
test?
They brought him in for a test, and they just took one look at it and went, take that off his head. Yeah, it was terrible.
Again, it's like a butterfly effect. You know, no Patrick Stewart as Picard, and he might not have been Professor X, and I don't know.
Yeah, the casting for that was interesting, though. Yafet Kotto was up for it.
That's
from
right.
Alien, which
I did not know that.
Mm. Yeah, he would have been.
Well, they wanted someone to out-Kirk Kirk.
Yeah.
The idea was that he was going to be a much more sort of bold and hands-on to make Kirk look positively intellectual. And then they kind of did a complete 180 and went with the...
Shifted. Well, if you remember the first episode, it was all Riker saying to Picard, I'm never going to let you go on an away mission. That's my job. You have to stay here safe on the ship. And like 87 away missions later.
All right, who's your favourite?
My favourite character is Commander Worf.
Oh, God, he's good.
He's my favourite character. And weirdly, my second is probably Captain Sisko.
Okay.
I would say. Captain Sisko is my favourite captain. I mean, he's not better than Picard in many ways. I just have a real affection for him. He was very, you know, once he got the goatee and shaved his head. Again, the facial hair being a landmark in a show getting better. He's genius. I love Sisko. I love his arc, you know, as a kind of messiah figure. The fact that he's prepared to do stuff that Picard would never have done.
What was it, in the cold moonlight?
Absolutely. Yeah. Which is all about propaganda and planting evidence to bring the more people onto their side of the war.
To bring an empire into a war.
Yeah, it's quite prescient. I mean, they did have the benefit of touching on much meatier issues.
Yeah.
Although Picard's torture at the hands of the Cardassians is a standout.
The Kardashians?
Yeah. The Kardashians, yes. Kim Kardashian sticks him in a room and it's quite upsetting.
Oh my God.
But yeah, Sisko's fantastic. And it's just, I think him as a captain is summed up by Q brilliantly, where he just lamps Q in the face and Q's like, you hit me. Picard never hit me. And he's just like, I'm not Picard. and never has that been more obvious. But for me, Worf was great in The Next Generation. And then when they ported him over to Deep Space Nine, he just came into his own. Any Klingon story was an absolute joy. On The Next Gen, the whole discommendation storyline with Tony Todd as his brother Kern.
Oh, yeah.
And Tony Todd, who's appeared in God knows how many Star Trek roles. He's been in all of them. You know, and then when he went to Deep Space Nine, you know, wandering around with his back left. Just the deadpan comedy.
Mm.
You know, the one where Q turns them all into Robin Hood and Worf comes on in times, sure, I protest, I am not a merry man. and the bit when they're playing baseball on the holodeck, called the holosuite, sorry, in Deep Space Nine, and they're going for the battery. It's like, where is he? And Worf goes, find him and kill him. So the guy running across the bases. Just genius, a genius character played by Michael Dorn.
Very quick, quickly, where do you stand on Q and Miles O'Brien?
Love Q. Love Miles O'Brien.
Love
although
Miles O'Brien.
I can only really see him now because I watch Hell on Wheels on AMC, and he's Mr. Durant in Hell on Wheels, who was a railroad tycoon. So now I only see him as that. But yeah, he will, I guess, be Chief O'Brien.
He will always be Chief O'Brien, and he's great as such. And again, he's another character who came into his own on Deep Space Nine because he suddenly had much more to do than he had done on.
And a really interesting backstory they gave him, that he'd fought in the Cardassian Wars, and he was a massive...
Cardassian Wars?
Yes. And he was a massive racist and hated the Cardassians, or the Cardies, as he called them. And they explored that quite well. Mm. Yeah, wow. He was a lot of fun with
them. They don't do anything to earn their money to take a load of selfies. It's just, it's crazy. Very quickly, best moment, best Star Trek moment across everything.
Oh, God, what are you doing?
I'm so sorry, we've got 5 minutes. Someone's going to chuck us out of the booth. I know we could literally be here all day talking about this stuff.
Death of Spock is brilliantly played. The end of the first episode, obviously, of Best of Both Worlds.
Yes, I am the cutest.
City on the Edge of Forever, where he has to make that choice. I think I like the moral dilemmas and the self sacrifice and just the enormous sacrifices. So clearly that says something disturbing about me. I'm trying to think of cheerier ones.
I think for me, there's the The Inner Light, the one where Picard picks up the box and he lives an entire life and grows old, has children, grandchildren, and dies, and it's all just in a moment. Mm. And he comes back.
Yeah.
And he goes into one of the Jefferies tubes and he pulls out that little flute and he plays a little song. And I was like, that is just, it's genius television.
Yeah.
I love the holodeck episodes. What's the one where they go, this is Sherlock Holmes, it's the big goodbye or something.
Oh, there's a lot of those. Moriarty.
And Moriarty escapes.
Yeah, he escapes the holodeck.
Yeah.
That's right, Moriarty escapes the holodeck.
The holodeck's a genius.
And there's another Moriarty episode, isn't there?
Oh, there's quite a few of them. Yeah. He becomes a recurring character.
They trick him into thinking that he's outside, but he's actually not outside, he's in the holodeck.
That's
still.
Right. And in the same way that John Rhys-Davies as Leonardo da Vinci turns up in Voyager. Mm. But they used to do that when they just think, oh God, we're a bit bored of doing Star Trek. Can we not just do a period drama? Oh, we've got a holodeck. Or when budgets were a bit tight and they wanted to do something. I mean, yeah, they had lots of fun. The Doctor, incidentally, in Voyager, another great character.
Oh, great
really
character,
like the
yeah.
Doctor.
So best moment for you?
Best moment. Oh God. I think I would have to be... It would have to be... Possibly, honestly, probably the last episode of The Next Generation, not because it's the best moment. This
it's
is a cop
not.
Out, just for what it means to me. Just when that show ended, the final moments of that, it destroyed me. It felt like I had lost a family. I was bereaved at the end of it, the thought that The Next Generation had ended. And I wasn't sure I could go on without these characters. I was so upset.
Why did was it cancelled? Did they just decide?
Ran its course. Yeah. They decided to pursue movies. You know.
Yeah, and I think they were all getting to the point where they were quite expensive. You know, when you get a long run.
Yeah, I mean, it was 7 years.
Like
so. Yeah. But I mean, the moment, the crowd pleasing moments are the huge space battles. So, Yesterday's Enterprise, phenomenal episode.
Yesterday's Enterprise, God.
You know, any of the Dominion War battles in Deep Space Nine, absolutely glorious. In terms of episodes, from Next Gen, obviously Best of Both Worlds, I'm going to say Darmok, when they go down to the planet with that alien race that only speaks in cultural metaphors.
Yes!
Which is, again, genius television.
You always talk about the episode of Deep Space Nine, which blends in with the trouble with Tribbles.
Oh, Trials and Tribulations.
Yeah.
And, where they cut the footage together.
Yes, mm. And Worf... Someone's they have the early Klingons, which look nothing like the.
We do not talk about it with outsiders. But they actually, in Enterprise, hilariously, they address why they don't have ridge foreheads.
Yeah.
And it's some ridiculous plot device that they use human DNA, and it takes a few generations for it to work it out of the gene pool. So for a few generations, they have flat foreheads. This is a thing. But yeah, just getting back to great episodes. Far Beyond the Stars, which is the DS9 episode where they kind of end up in sort of like 50s New York, which is mental, where all the characters are playing human characters. It's a very odd one. The Visitor, where old Jake Sisko, Tony Todd again, comes back to visit his dad. Also fantastic. I mean, there are just so many. And as you said, in the pale moonlight, the propaganda DS9. See, all my favourites are DS9, it seems. So much, we could go on for hours just doing this, but we won't, and I will tell you why, because we will be putting up a list of the greatest Star Trek episodes in order next week on the website, so do keep an eye out for that.
Awesome. Or pick up the mag for all of the and more.
Yeah, just to, you know, do the hard sell. The supplement is fantastic. It has exclusive interviews with loads of people from Star Trek, including Bill Shatner.
Indeed.
That Jamie spoke to. There's pieces in all the films, pieces in all the TV shows. A letter from Justin Lin. We have a piece written about Leonard Nimoy by his son, Adam Nimoy. We have an amazingly, really, really hard Star Trek quiz, which I was going to subject James to live on the podcast.
I wrote it.
But yeah, to see how much he knew about it. Because apparently there's something wrong wrong in it? Or is it
there's
it,
nothing wrong in my quiz. Okay. I wrote that quiz. There is nothing wrong with that quiz. To be fair, and I will say this on the podcast, I wrote that quiz, but I did have some help from Ed Gross and my friend Andy Fisher, who's a massive Trekkie. So okay. It wasn't just me.
There's a celebration of all the red shirts who've died over the years as well.
Do you know there's a red shirt perfume? It was on sale 1 year at Comic-Con.
I wouldn't wear that.
It smells like rich mahogany.
No, no. The blurb was, for the man who lives for today, because who knows if tomorrow will ever happen.
Blimey. O'Reilly.
Yeah. No, it's not just because we wrote it. It really is a phenomenal supplement. I like it a lot.
It is great.
Whole history of Star Trek, basically.
Yeah.
Buy it now.
58 pages.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's in the new issue of Empire, priced £4.99, all good and evil newsagents, on sale now, etc., etc., etc. And that is it. That is it for this Star Trek special. We look disappointed. We could talk about this thing all day.
I mean, I still need to know where the Universal Translator goes and who got that working and why they never need serviced. But let's move on.
Presumably you see all that stuff happening off camera. You know, I want to know where the toilets are. I mean, I know this feels like something I have an obsession with.
Jonathan Frakes actually addresses that in a Star Trek documentary, though slightly facetiously. He points out where the toilet is.
Well, it's funny. Thing, because 23rd century, you'd think that they would have done away with the need to poo. Maybe they have.
Maybe when you get transported, it just, takes
maybe,
care of that.
What if Picard's chair is also a toilet?
No.
Number one.
Nope.
And you thought he was talking to Riker all the time.
Make it so. On that bombshell.
Yeah.
Why do we have to leave it there? Oh,
I don't know. It's just the way of things. That's it for this very special Star Trek edition of the Empire Podcast. Join us every Friday for the regular Empire Podcast. If you don't already subscribe, please do. And if you would be so kind to go to iTunes and give us a lovely 5-star review. You know, only if you feel we deserve it, of course. You know, we won't pay you to do so. Will we? Can we pay people to
No, we can't.
We can't. Yes, we've got all the latinum and plutonium that we have lying around. We will give it to you. So please do that as well. Look out over the next few weeks for the Star Trek Beyond spoiler special as well. That's going to be fantastic. We haven't recorded our bit yet, but we have recorded interviews with Justin Lin and Simon Pegg, which are very, very good. So that's great. Keep an eye out for that one as well. Until then, it is goodbye from Jimbo.
You have been and always will be my podcast.
And it is goodbye from Helen.
Of all the podcasts I've encountered in my travels, this one has been the most human.
And it's goodbye from me. Live long and prosper. Thanks for listening. Bye. Everyone remember where we parked?